Welcome to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. One of my favorite composers of all times is Joseph Haydn. But I must admit that the development of this love went a little bit through my brain. I want to take you on a small ride of how that happened and how that helped me to appreciate him more, also on an emotional level. When I was a young student at the Amsterdam Conservatory, it was the first time people explained to me that not only can you listen to music and play music, but you can also analyze it and think about it and speak about it. Never before, really, had I sort of dived into this. My violin and my piano teacher, of course, had taught me that, you know, what an allegro is or what an andante is, or and my organ teacher, you know, explained me maybe the beginnings of what a fugue, how a fugue is constructed, or things like that. But that was sort of all I knew. So my teachers at the conservatory started to explain us the rules of harmony, the history of music, the analysis of form also. And in musical analysis, we spoke about how a sonata form is built, how a rondo is built, how a lied is constructed, a fugue, things like that. Now, to young students, and maybe also to listeners, musical theory can sometimes sound a little bit rigid. Music is something we want to enjoy with our feelings. Romantic music taught us that music doesn't have to be understood with our brain. It has to appeal to us directly, and we can just feel it. Rules are for mathematics and for physics, and not for music. I was, of course, no exception. I was 18, and I wanted freedom, no rules. But our analysis teacher, Job Eisenman was his name, he was smart. Of course, he had to explain the great classical rules, which, indeed, they seemed a little bit rigid. You have theme A in this tonality, you have theme B in this tonality, and this melody is structured with 2x4 and then 8 bars conclusion. The development section takes all these elements and puts them in a different light, and then the whole theme comes back in different tonalities, and the piece finishes. Whatever. That's your sort of structure of a sonata. By the way, this rigid 2, 4, 8, or 16 bar structure is also the basis of much older music, like folk music, and it is still the basis of most of our pop music, of house and hip-hop and soul and funk. You can dance to it because the meter is predictable. Back to the conservatory. Our analysis teacher explained the rules, and then he immediately moved to Joseph Haydn. Always Haydn. And quickly, in the course of a few lessons, Joseph Haydn transformed from this old, sort of boring, predictable composer to a rebel, a funny rebel even, who played never-ending games with his listener. How did that happen? The problem for us students was that as soon as we had to start analyzing Haydn, we got extremely confused. Because it looked like he was very rigid and precise, but there was always something off. And many times there were many things off. The theme was not 4 but 5 bars. The second theme came in 1 bar too early. The repetition was not really an exact repetition, but it was sort of a variation. And no matter which movement of which of his 104 symphonies we were given, there was always some inventive confusion. He wasn't following the rules, or it was clear that he was fully aware of the rules, but Haydn put small and big surprises everywhere to keep his listeners awake. Let's listen to a little bit from a slow movement from his string quartet, Opus 57 in C. My amazing friends from the Dutch Dudok Quartet are playing. It starts with a beautiful long melody that any ordinary composer would have enjoyed working out in a way a normal lead would develop. But not Haydn. He liberates the first violin completely and makes it fly away in utterly unexpected ways. Now, we go back to my student days. So in his symphonies, the bigger surprises were sort of easy to find for us students. A sudden loud entry where you would expect a continuation of a soft melody, or an empty, silent bar where you would expect a connection to the next part. But the smaller surprises were harder. One bar too many or too little puts the balance off, but only when you really pay attention. It's not a big shock, but it's the hint of, you know, the hint of Tabasco in the normal spaghetti bolognese that an uncreative cook wouldn't dare to put, but that can completely transform the taste palette. The difficult thing for us in the 21st century is that in order to appreciate these surprises, we have to do a couple of things that for an audience in Haydn's time was very, very easy. First, we have to have some sort of a basic knowledge of the rules of their language, even as an audience. It's nothing out of the ordinary, but the more we know about this language, the more we can expect how to develop, and the more we can also be surprised how it doesn't develop. Just to give you one example of a fabulous shock moment in this symphony number 101, I will play two small fragments. We go to the second movement. So you hear the same music, first in a normal four bars, as you would expect. Wait, I take the score, because I'm going to sing the meter. It goes like this. Dum padam padam pam, dum padam padam pam, yum padam 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 padam. Completely logical. And then the second time it comes, Haydn shocks us. We expect the same thing to happen, but then it doesn't. Effect. We were just sitting back in our comfortable chair, thinking we knew what was coming, and Haydn took us by utter surprise. Not only does he come in one bar too early, he also comes in suddenly very loud and in a completely unexpected tonality. He took us by surprise. Or did he now? Because we know much of this music so well. Which brings me to the second thing we need to do to appreciate it, which is that we have to sort of unhear the music. We have to pretend to not know it. When you expect the surprise, you can be surprised. And this is a big, big problem. The pieces became so popular, played over and over again, sometimes even nicknamed after the big surprise. I mean, when you announce in your program Haydn's Symphony No. 103, with the nickname with the drum roll, then the entire audience obviously starts waiting for the drum roll and feels a happy confirmation that indeed it starts with a drum roll. Now, how on earth can we be, again, totally surprised by this truly crazy beginning, which I'm sure the people who first heard this piece in London in 1795 were? It's a question that I'm not sure how to answer, other than that maybe some of these pieces need to be played a little bit less often, or we should at least take out the nicknames in the programs. This brings me to the third thing we need to do as performers and as listeners. If we want to feel the full scope of the surprises, we have to listen not as consumers of well-known music, but as active participants in a discovery game, really trying to sort of follow what happens. This is not so easy. And the omnipresence of music in our society as a background accompaniment hasn't made it easier. Music is always everywhere. and we don't take part in it. It's wallpaper. But actively engaging with what happens is very, very different. If we manage to do this, though, on the one hand, to be slightly informed about the language, and on the other hand, being open and sort of curious like a baby, then we have the perfect listening attitude for Joseph Haydn, and we will be pleasured and tortured at the same time by his wonderful inventiveness. I want to finish this podcast with the opening of his 101st symphony, the one that I'm preparing at the moment. He wrote it for a visit to London. The first 23 bars are a sort of weird search for secure ground. The harmony is unclear, the meter is unclear, everything is unclear. And even when he seems to find the secure ground and the sort of faster theme starts, this theme is a little bit off as he keeps throwing in single bars into a frame that should be a simple four-bar structure. I would have loved to invite Haydn himself for this podcast and question him about this. Last week, I was in Vienna and I walked past the house where he lived for many, many years. Also during the time when he wrote this symphony. I fantasized about visiting him there, you know, asking him a couple of questions about the tempo, about the quality of a subito forte, the color of a certain piano. I would have loved to see if he was a funny man, light, or if he was, on the contrary, severe and strict. Unfortunately, he didn't materialize, and I will have to be guessing my best guesses when I conduct his music. At least, the inventiveness and the surprising treasures I keep finding in his music will never cease to inspire me. Thank you for listening to The Treasure Hunt. I will put links to the pieces in the show notes. If there are subjects you would like me to speak about in this podcast, contact me through my website or on Twitter. My name there is @Vierasbass. Please follow this podcast on your favorite platform and stay tuned for the next episode.